This is Dyslexic Design Thinking. For the past 25 years, Gil Gershoni has been the head of his own branding agency, Gershoni Creative. And one of the things he's passionate about rebranding is his dyslexia. In this series, Gil sits down with members of the dyslexic community for eye-opening conversations about the intersection of dyslexia and creativity, and what dyslexia can teach us about ourselves and the world around us. Today, Gil talks to Jake Swantko, the director of photography for the Oscar-winning documentary Icarus. Jake was also nominated for a British Academy Film Award for his work on the documentary The Dissident. Enjoy!
Welcome, Jake.
Thank you so much for having me, Gil.
Such a pleasure, man. It's great to have you here. You've worked on several award-winning films. When did you first know that you wanted to be a cinematographer? When did that first happen for you?
Well, you know, I think filmmaking has always been a part of my life as a kid. You know, I think when in the absence of being able to read and write, you know, dyslexia was a very big hurdle in kind of finding my place in information, in the information world, right? And so movies were this way that I learned a great deal of things, and I was able to imagine a lot of things when I was a kid playing. And I never really quite understood my place in filmmaking, or even really that my brain was working in this way, that I was learning most of my information through what was happening around me and through watching movies and, you know, the distillation of that information. But filmmaking sort of came to me later in life. I went to school as a journalist to become a writer, and I had a teacher put a camera in my hand, and I found it, I was able to speak much better and much more fluently with images and sound and the confluence of filmmaking to express my ideas. So that was sort of the start. Journalism entered into documentary, and documentary entered into, you know, basically the space that I am now, in between kind of a hybrid of cinematic documentary and also fiction and commercial kind of work.
What in your mind makes a great cinematographer?
So much of what makes a good cinematographer is the ability to have an eye. And so the eye is the most important thing with any cinematographer. All other skills can sort of be acquired and learned through experience. But the eye is basically the perspective in which you see things and the way you understand the world under certain circumstances, where the camera should be placed, how that should be lit, how you're understanding these things. It all comes from this mosaic of information of your experiences, of where you've traveled, the things you've touched, places you've been, people you've met. You know, we may come to like, oh, it should kind of look like this because everyone kind of does it like that. And then you go, no, I want to do it this way. I want to do it the way that I see it. And I'm going to take risks that way. But see, stepping outside of the norm in that respect is kind of risky. So I think it's developing that eye and then trusting with a degree of risk to just go with it, just like to be like unequivocally yourself. You know, I think that's the main goal, is just to be unapologetically yourself. You're obviously trying to meet the demands of whatever creative aesthetic there is as a part of a project. Mm-hmm. But you just, as I think you get more settled into the way you think and the way you see the world, people come to really value the fact that you do take risks and that you don't do things like everybody else. And that just kind of takes time to build faith in.
I love that. You know, how does dyslexia play that role of how you see your signature identity with the cinematography? I mean, when you look at, as you described, the light, when you look at your the way you see the world, can you talk a little bit about how dyslexia work well together with your profession?
The ability to really feel things and to step into other people's shoes is probably the greatest asset that I have as a human being, I think, is to step into situations, especially in the past films that I've worked on as, you know, as a producer, a director of photography, as a filmmaker. These stories I should have no real connection to in terms of where I come from. I grew up in Seattle, Washington. I went to school in Oregon, and I'm working with Saudi dissidents who are in Montreal, Canada. I'm working with Russian dissidents in Moscow. These people I should have no ability to relate to whatsoever. And yet at its base value, many people in what I do, and I'd say most people in the world, have a desire to be understood. And they're willing to disclose that information if they feel that there's an appropriate conduit in front of them to receive it. So I try and be the person that is magnanimous with my time and my effort. And I truly try and empathize with the situation by spending long periods of time with these people and expressing to them my understanding of what they're going through, even as impossible as that is. So I would say it's probably one of my greatest assets.
I love that. And I know you and I talked about in the past before about that sort of ability to see empathy and to relate to other, even though they're in different worlds. And as a dyslexic, to be able to connect different worlds, if it's the story, what underneath the story, the setup of the scene or the lighting, all the details, but really be able to almost be in it and not of it so you can kind of direct it. I love the way you're explaining that. Something that I know I can very much relate to. And a lot of dyslexics have that gift that they can kind of see non-related to the linear mind things and kind of understand how they relate to each other, you know?
Yeah, it's a kind of a strange pattern recognition. And also sort of like once you start to understand, like, you know, a film is like a complex matrix of different scenes and elements that are coming together to create one overall statement, right? So when you start to think about it, and when you film all these different bits of information throughout the course of making a film, you start to look at the edit as it comes together and you start to piece together like, well, this relates to this, or I remember shooting this scene with this particular person that would fit here and the editors still have not seen it. I need to go back through and show them to really look. And so it's a process of like these really disparate far connections of different information. And I'm fortunate enough, the one to be acquiring all this information, and the editors are taking it from a different perspective and cutting it together. So it's also partly my job to impart the empathy of what happened during the scene. I'm hoping to convey this emotion because it was very palpable in the room. I want people to feel this. And so it's kind of like a really balance of two different perspectives because they're coming from a much more objective point of view. And mine is I was in the room, you know.
Yeah, beautiful. You've worked with director Brian Fogel on two films, Icarus, which won an Oscar. Congratulations, that's amazing.
Thank you.
And The Dissident, which was nominated for the British Academy Film Awards. What is special about the way you and Brian collaborate?
Well, we actually have done three films. There's a sequel to Icarus that's going to come out here shortly that was all kind of following the backstory of Grigory Rodchenkov after he disclosed the information that was in Icarus and entered into a form of protection in the United States. You know, I think it's just an interesting balance. I think filmmaking is involved a lot of different dynamics, and his and my dynamic has worked. And he came to me with the idea of The Dissident, and it's just a good working relationship in that, you know, it's rare to work with somebody that really, truly trusts your creative vision for things and kind of lets you do your own thing. I think a lot of the stuff that I do in my work since I have started working has been alone in the field with other people and other things. I generally do work to a degree alone. And in certain circumstances, it doesn't call for that. Obviously, you need large crews of people to shoot, you know, interviews with politicians or something. But a lot of these really intimate moments in films of the nature that these are, which are highly volatile, highly sensitive, kind of on the extreme form of information in documentaries that have consequential information in them, like meaning, you know, that what people say could get them killed or put in prison. Oftentimes these scenes really happen with just only one person in the room, and you feel tremendously grateful to have the opportunity to be in a room where people reveal themselves in such a way that would not have been possible otherwise if there had been so many people in the room. You know, I think you kind of work in this balance of navigating your relationship with these people, and at some point, they either decide to trust you with a lot of what they're holding inside of them. And those become these huge moments in these films where, through the shock and awe, what we always still relate to, I think, is people. I mean, people tell these stories. The stories of people help us to understand information that will really, truly last with us. You know, I think facts just kind of read very flat. But when you have somebody that is brilliantly articulating what's happening in their lives and how poignant they can be on camera, we really start to truly understand this information through the vessel of these people. So I think, you know, Brian and I's relationship really works because he trusts me a great deal. And it's an amazing to have a partner that kind of agrees that a lot of these things will happen if there isn't a huge footprint.
I know that Steven Spielberg has been a big inspiration for you. What about him and his work impacted you? Like, what really inspires you about his approach to filmmaking, to art?
Yeah, I think Spielberg holds a special place in my dyslexic heart, also my kid's heart, because, you know, at the time I was really struggling in school. I mean, I couldn't read, couldn't write. I mean, his movies were hitting their true form at this time. You had Jaws, you had Jurassic Park, you had Raiders of the Lost Ark. I mean, all these are touch in on like the marvelous imagination that we have as kids, and just this cinematic eye that he has, you know, the way he composes the actors, the idiosyncrasies that you see, just all these little elements just cue up my brain so much. And later on in life too, of the minutiae and things you see in films like Saving Private Ryan and, you know, any of his other films, you know, he taps into this really cinematic eye. He understands. You know, I think there's other dyslexic directors been a great deal of inspiration for me too. And Steve McQueen and Guy Ritchie, just amazing filmmakers. You start to see their films and you go, this is really strange, because you see the way that they're composing and the themes they take on that start to play in your mind a bit. As like, I'm seeing through this person's lens, you know, I understand where they're creating all of these different things from. And, you know, I think that's a real interesting thing, as a filmmaking is a truly empathetic gift that we have to convey life in ways that other art forms cannot. You know, I think truly good filmmaking can approach life in a canvas of life for understanding very complex issues in our human existence that other mediums cannot.
How do you think dyslexia is perceived in the film industry? Is it perceived as an asset, or do you think it's still perceived as a liability like other industries?
Well, I would just say, I don't know how it's perceived. I would assume, I mean, I know how I perceive it. I get excited anytime I hear somebody has dyslexia. You know, I just like can't wait to talk to these people, just to understand what side they're coming from in terms of that model. That is a lot of the strengths that we have. But also, you know, there's still like, I mean, I talk to, you know, therapists and psychologists about these things, and they still don't really understand a lot of the strengths. I mean, a lot of them still really view this as just only a learning disorder, and the problems associated with it are solved once you learn how to read and write. This is very still, I mean, but I would guess, if you pulled Hollywood, people work in visual arts, and if you could come to a consensus about the number of dyslexics that work in the industry, I think it would be a surprising number. That's just my guess. But, you know, I think what I'm kind of interested in the space of dyslexia is also, you know, we talk about diversity so much with skin color and ethnicity and background. At what point are we going to take a look at neurodiversity in people, and the people that have extremely specialized skills that are not meant for a broader system of kind of complacency? You know, I think, and it's not to say that one subset of people is more special than the other. It's just saying, simply put, like, there are people with strengths in certain areas that should be utilized towards certain industries. And, you know, to say that these people might be better suited in these fields is not like, is backed by research and can help both employers and employees achieve what they want to do. So I think once dyslexia becomes cool, I think that once there's a wider understanding of what this is, and the same way with autism as well, you know, I think that people will start to understand and embrace the fact that, like, yeah, these people do this specific sort of thing, or they have skill sets in pattern recognition. They have skill sets in a repertory theater of their mind. They have a brilliant imagination. They're interdisciplinary between a lot of different arts. Yeah, they're going to have trouble sending fucking emails. You know, they're going to have trouble, you know, doing these things. Right. They may have trouble with time management, but we're not hiring them to do that. We'll hire somebody else to facilitate that because there's people that can work in that field. I think, you know, the hope is that becomes a bit of a cognitive revolution, and that there are people with different minds that are better suited towards different occupations. And for you, as somebody that doesn't think in a straight line, like we don't, for us to understand sooner than later that is a strength in some fields and a weakness in others is extremely important to our well-being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, beautifully said. And I think conversations like these are exactly where I think we're trying to show and change the narrative and change the mislabeling of the disability into a hyperability.
Yeah.
Not to say that we don't have challenges like everybody else, but it's not only about our challenges that defines who we are. And, you know, the more we focus about what we can do, the more at least the conversation is more balanced. Let's go kind of like to the beginning. When were you diagnosed? And when did you learn that you were dyslexic?
Well, the educational system was really, you know, kind of baffled by my inability to learn things. And, you know, to your point, and it's kind of interesting because, you know, you and I are now removed. We're professionals. We've succeeded. But so much of why I talk and why I do the things I do, or why I love being a part of this conversation, is for the kids that were like us, because I know what it's like to struggle. It's no joke. I mean, it is really, in retrospect, what we were talking about, the shame and the embarrassment of it. When you're that young of a kid, that is like huge. And especially if you're in an underprivileged community, you don't have a whole lot of choices in terms of where you go when you're continually told you're the dumbest kid in the room. And it's basically leads to a life of crime, you know? And so it's a big deal. And the fact that I feel that so many of these kids have gifts, and if they're given just a hint of positivity, give them some sort of skill that gets them moving towards the strengths of their mind, that they'll actually be able to actualize some sort of brilliant life that, you know. But back to your point, sorry, I kind of went off track, but the educational system was baffled by it. I couldn't learn simple arithmetic. I mean, I still don't know how to do times tables. I couldn't tell you what 8 times 4 is. And my spelling is still bad. I still don't know how to spell mountain. So, you know, they were just confused what was going on, and it lasted for a long time. And it was compounded by the fact that my dad changed jobs. So I would be in different school systems where, you know, and also around the time that I was in school, I don't know how much has changed now, but public schools and the nature of the special education system was not necessarily a very like specialized set of tools for people that had various disabilities. Basically, anybody that had a disability was kind of grouped in one big classroom. And, you know, that was just kind of the way it worked in public schools. So I struggled a lot in school. I didn't learn a lot in school. If it wasn't for the love of my parents, I don't know exactly what type of life I would have led, because they sensed that I had something else inside of me. They understood my nature beyond the classroom, and they took money that they didn't have and put me into a specialist. The woman by the name of Pat Sharp basically taught me how to read and write in a year, and it changed my life. It changed my life. And sports really helped also, too. I played baseball, and that gave me a lot of confidence, because when you're good at sports, it's okay to not be the best in school. But although after I learned how to read and write, I mean, I was like a 3.5 or 3.2 GPA or something like that. It's like a B plus average, maybe. So it was just always, school was always like, I had to work two or three times harder than other kids. Like, you know, it's like always this. I remember I'm reading something like, dyslexics are sort of like, there's a wall and that wall has a ladder and everyone else is using the ladder, but for some reason the dyslexic can't, they have to figure another way around the wall, and it's just going to take a lot more time, but that's just the way they have to do it. You know, that's just the way it's got to be done.
When did it click for you that dyslexia could be a positive versus a negative? I mean, it's kind of in the hill of your story. I mean, when did you like, wow, that was like, I struggle in university, but then maybe that's more of a gift than a disability.
I think, you know, I can't speak on behalf of other dyslexics, but we have a very strange relationship with our dyslexia. A lot of us deal with a great deal of shame. You know, I think it's a staggering amount of shame that kind of can cripple a lot of us later in life, and it's difficult to overcome self-doubt. And so once I got older, and I became more comfortable with, not comfortable, but I started to like the way I thought. And it's not that I thought that it was unique. I just knew that I have this sense inside of me to see sequences, to feel emotion, to feel music, the confluence of which can come together in film scenes that enriched my life and could move people. I saw that what I was doing, I could use my mind in ways that moved people. And that's when I started to feel like I wanted to embrace more of this and to become more of a person that was willing to take risks to put those things together. And it wasn't until, you know, maybe I was in my late 20s that I started to really understand, because I always researched it a little bit. You know, I think with passing interest, I would, you know, look into it. And it wasn't until I read some literature on it that, and the really brilliant thing about the literature of reading the stories of other dyslexics is it is so strikingly you every time you read some of these stories. You're like, oh my God, this guy is talking, this guy or chick. I mean, they could be on some other side of the world and have some completely different perspective about nature versus nurture, but it's literally the story that they're telling is like, it hits you right in the stomach. You're, I know that kid.
You know, every time I talk to another dyslexic, I find a lost brother and sister, because there's so much, you connect and you realize you're not alone. You're in a group of amazing individuals. And as a young child, you struggle, but you know that there is a moment where you're going to realize your gift.
It is, yeah. I think when we're younger too, it's difficult to, I think you really feel isolated as a kid. You know, you really feel different in all the wrong ways. And once you realize there's a community of people out there that are like you, that are doing really brilliant things that you're also interested in and have become highly successful, you know, to me, the magic and the key to setting dyslexic kids, you know, is giving them the opportunity to see what they're good at. And once they get the opportunity to see what they're really, their mind was meant to do, regardless of what that is, they will inhale it and they will become so good at it. And they just need encouragement. And so I, you know, if anything, I hope that through the work that you do or anything that I can do to help is that we just give these kids, when they're in these really vulnerable positions, to know that like, once you get out of school, man, or whatever you decide to do, you're going to really excel if you can choose to embrace the way you think.
Beautiful. You know, I was talking to a young child, you know, first or second grade, and he's like, I don't know. And the advice that sort of in conversation was sort of came out was like, what do you like to do? What gives you joy? Oh, I love playing baseball. Then baseball is your dyslexia. Then just feed your dyslexia with doing the things you like to do. And before you know it, you get obsessed about it because you can see the ball, the timing, the individual sports as it turned into a team sports, all the mechanics of it. And what advice would you give to a young, inspiring filmmaker with dyslexia?
Well, there's practical and there's philosophical. And I think I'll try and give you both. Although I don't have the answers to either of these questions yet, I'll just try and work them out. I would say so much of what's important in a practical filmmaking sense is for my dyslexia is to build a repertoire of understanding the natural environment, of traveling, of if you can experience people and their stories, the more we feel, the more we can give that back to the world. And I think the ability to continually be in situations where you are inspired is so important, regardless if that's a filmmaking situation or not. If you think about life, life is filmmaking. Life is one fragmented sequence of a really long movie. And basically, we're pulling episodic memory or creating a linear story to tell a life story, right? So the more we observe of life acutely and with our own perspective about what life is, the better movies we'll make. So watch a lot of movies, look at a lot of pictures. I think that's a huge part of the information processing system for me. Watch the movies you love over and over again, read about them if you can, and experience the images of the world, you know, because there's so much information in them and we can understand that information. You'll see one picture and it'll remind you of a picture you saw 10 years ago. And you'll go, maybe I want to make the lighting look like this in this scene. Maybe that will work here. Maybe I can position somebody in this way that picture was sort of, I like the feel of the atmosphere of that picture. Or, you know, I want this scene to have the feeling of this movie. So we're working in this kind of gist environment where we're like, I'm pulling from here and I'm pulling some stuff from here. I like, you know, Beethoven here. Maybe we'll put a little bit of that in here and we'll spin it all together. And then you're just pulling all these interdisciplinary things, you know, literature, all. So just keep building that mosaic of information. And from like a philosophical space to be an aspiring filmmaker is, you know, at some point we as dyslexics have to overcome our fear and self-doubt to say something. So much of our life was standing in front of a crowded classroom, bumbling out the words to a sentence we couldn't read, and it creates a tremendous amount of panic. Mm. And still to this day, it still runs chills up my neck. So what we have to do in essence as filmmakers is come to terms with our fears of the world, real or perceived, and stand in front of that classroom and say what we want to say with dignity, and to tell the truth that we've acquired over the life that we've lived. And that is basically the story, I think, of our lives, is overcoming that sense of inadequacy. And when you finally do have enough courage, despite all the odds, to stand and face yourself, it's when you truly start to understand the power of who you can become, and that there is extreme amount of harmony in what people once told you was a disorder.
Wow. Amazing. Beautiful, man. I love talking with you so much, man. I really appreciate your time and your transparency and honesty and vulnerability. And obviously it shows up in space in your work, but it's great to be able to connect and talk about the intersection of dyslexia and creativity through your lens. So thank you so much, Jake, for joining us today.
Pleasure. It's a real pleasure. Always happy to talk to you, Gil.
Thank you, Jake, for joining us today. For those of you who are interested in learning more about Jake, you can follow him on Instagram at Swantco or visit his website at jakeswantco.com. I am Gil Gershoni, and you've been listening to Dyslexic Design Thinking.
If you enjoyed our conversation today, be sure to subscribe to this series wherever you get your podcasts and follow along on Instagram at Dyslexic Design Thinking. You can also drop us a line at dyslexia@gershoni.com to receive our monthly newsletter and learn about our upcoming programming. Dyslexic Design Thinking is produced by Gershoni Creative. Until next time, be well.